This is Poetry on the Move. In this episode, Trinidadian British poet and writer Vani Capildeo. Vani Capildeo is Douglas Castor Cultural Fellow at the University of Leeds. Her 7 publications include Measures of Expatriation, which won the 2016 Forward Poetry Prize's Best Collection Award, Simple Complex Shapes, a sequence completed during the Judith E. Wilson Poetry Fellowship at the University of Cambridge, and Utter, inspired by a former job as a lexicographer at the Oxford English Dictionary. She enjoys cross-genre writing and interdisciplinary collaboration and has created performances based on Shakespeare, Euripides, and Guyanese poet Martin Carter. She writes a regular column for PN Review, and she appeared at the Poetry on the Move Festival with support from the British Council. IPSI's Jen Webb interviewed Vani while she was at the Poetry on the Move Festival as International Poet in Residence. Vani is reading from her IPSI chapbook, Seas and Trees, beginning with the poem Framboyan.
There's a kind of tree which grows in a lot of different hot climates, and you will know it by various names. I grew up knowing it as flamboyant. It's got a smooth, silverish rind for a bark. It's got an umbrella-shaped canopy and very flamey flowers. It's also known as Framboyan in Spanish, or Royal Ponciana. It occurs both in Jean Rhys and in Aimé Césaire, the Caribbean writers, and it is thought in some territories of the Caribbean that to be buried under flamboyant tree is to have a vertical ascent into some version of heaven, which is not what this is about. Framboyan. That trees had evolved to eat other trees. That this happened at the end of a garden. That this was first noticed in a small tree's wincing. That the larger tree was bending in, whipped by no wind, a flamboyant tree and not in flower, bunched to a beak. Dwarf and royal Ponciana trees, almost one kind, at the end of a Trinidad childhood garden. That the small tree visibly respired, menaced, yet stock still, spread and ruffled, animal, yet green, this one, yes, in flower as if on fire, yet in devouring distress, letting air in, yet feather-tipped and all aflame, just like an offshoot of what stood over. Hardly leafed, intent and purposeful, stacked alto stratus stormbark, discovering its due, moved in to take, concave against odds of weather. Pitiless, we witness small uprootings, turn with each untree-like recommencing, retreat further into the house, feel ourselves delicate, stridently walk, shuddering, bolts shut, instinct outraged. Know we are next who shall be due to fall under green shade. But lock the doors, the well-made doors, investments, property. The thing is busy outside. That tree evolved to eat other trees. It is good our doors are good. And indeed it centered in the earth, the slate, the concrete. And indeed it entered wading, for our doors were wood.
I love the sense of plurality in your language, the playfulness, the juxtaposition of unexpected words, and the sense in your poetry that something odd is happening in the world. And I wondered, like you, I'm a migrant, and when you move a lot from country to country, you don't know the idiom, sometimes you don't know the language, sometimes you don't look right. Yeah. And because you aren't necessarily at home in that world, I think one tends to look more carefully and see the oddities in the world rather than the norms, the normalness. And I just want to ask you about your sense of expatriation and of the ways in which, as we travel and put ourselves into different places, unfamiliar places, if the world then is defamiliarized and becomes fresh and new.
There's something I've been noticing since I've been doing large amounts of travel, such as this extraordinary and very happy trip over 3 days from Scotland to Australia. And what I've been noticing is the parallel value of what I'd called micro-travel in a recent article for Ranta. So the way in which even travelling along one road that you might think you know very well, you can do things like switch history if you're walking with somebody very much older, or switch class. For example, if you're going on foot in a place where people normally go by car, which happened to me in the piece I wrote for Ranta, I decided in a sort of radical way in a diplomatic neighbourhood to go for a walk, which nobody does. Immediately started being followed by a vagrant who was squatting in one of the abandoned diplomatic houses. And I eventually tried to ring a doorbell of someone I knew. But because I was with this man, the person I knew completely failed to recognize me as myself. So simply by the fact of walking instead of being in a car, I had acquired a different identity. I had defamiliarized myself in the place. And that's something I think I became sensitive to from the large movements of travel, is that there isn't really any level, I'm sure even if you locked people up in a factory, there isn't any level where you don't find some kind of perhaps quite abrupt migration in terms of people's internal imaginations and perceptions. It could be something as little as, are you going to the women's bathrooms or the unisex bathrooms? And there are these boundaries that people are crossing all the time.
And maybe we aren't always as alert to them as we could be.
Exactly, until for some reason you find you've done that. And I think when you've done the very big ones, then you start noticing when people are doing the smaller ones every day.
And noticing in yourself when you do the smaller ones, perhaps.
Yes, though I think you get that as well from going to a sex-segregated school the way I did, growing up in a country where people have several different religions, but don't have any problem thinking if they belong to two or three at once.
Oh, that's interesting.
Yeah, it's quite funny.
Yeah.
Around exam time, it's funny, because people do charms and sort of lucky things from every religion they can gather.
You never know which god is going to be looking after you.
Yes, yes.
So keep them all handy.
I'd like to make a strange note here about colour, which, if any of you can remember the Estee Lauder lipstick Neoclassic Coral, when Trinidadian sunlight shines through the wings of scarlet ibis at sunset, just as they're going to roost, they are this completely unnatural colour in nature. Neoclassic Coral. Really, they're lipstick birds. Fave. Sometimes I dream in a language that is mine only by scratches, but I can get the tune of it, a whole conversation between strangers friendly to each other, dawdling behind me, somewhere outdoors, a sandy cone of syllables rising and falling, whole sentences coming smattering to the surface from an occluded source. Sometimes it is the actual people around me on a journey, whose language drifts into another throughout my dreams, the prerequisite for transformation always being that both tunes already are familiar to my memory, so that the Irish have become Jamaican, the Spanish Trinidadian, while the French stay French but sound maternal, a loving 39. Some time ago, I dreamt that I could no longer see by means of light. Without knowing by experience, or even scientifically, what this would involve, I saw by means of heat. How gradually I registered the changeable reddish dark, and that my dream environment was room-like and enclosure, and that the pulsing blue was situated in someone not unlike yourself, whose breathing seemed too loud to me because of the lack of light, and how instead of speaking, you comforted my shoulder, both incandescing white.
I read that poem half a dozen times, and I kept coming back to the French remain French, but sound maternal.
Mm. Well, there's a sort of pun in there, because, of course, mother tongue in French, it'd be langue maternelle. Mm. And there's a curious statistic that at least by about 2012 to 13, which is when I last checked it, the International Organization of Francophonie claimed that there were 600 people in Trinidad who had French as their mother tongue. Now, my mother actually spoke a lot in French to me when I was a child. Mm. And when she was 39, I would have been 4, which is when I remember looking at a sort of children's illustrated French dictionary with her. So I decided just to put in that particularity there.
One moment of autobiography.
Yes, one moment of autobiography, but also to facilitate the entry of the pun between maternal and langue maternelle.
Yes. Oh, I love that. And of course, you mentioned footnotes as you before you started reading the poem.
Yes.
And you spoke very eloquently about footnotes the other day. Footnotes not common in poetry. Could you talk a little bit about that?
I'm longing to rat on a publisher here, actually. But I really shouldn't do that, should I? Who invited me out to lunch when I had been talking to a friend, well, an older poet friend, about my second completed book, On Draining Sea. And he'd sent it to this publisher. And I didn't know why he wanted to meet me for lunch. It seemed incredibly Bloomsbury era, but I went. And he went to tell me that it's because my work was anti-poetic, destructive of poetry, it should never be published because it made people feel stupid. Because I had put notes and acknowledgements at the end and I had epigraphs. But the thing was, I had used some foreign material, some of it going back to 17th century, out of print travel books by people like William Dampier and Charles César de Rochefort. So it seemed only fair. And I thought at least in three ways about footnotes. One is that one can't expect everybody to know everything. And if you think something doesn't need footnoting, it's because there's an imagined, universal, hegemonic, oppressive, probably white supremacist, heteropatriarchal, military-industrial complex.
You go, girl!
No, but really, that probably you're pre-programmed with something incredibly boring, and so you think that's universal. So anything really interesting, even the botanical term, might need a footnote. The second thing is there might be an artwork or a work of literature which for whatever reason is rare or lost. So it's a way of honouring and connecting with the distant and dead who might be an inspiration to others, whom others might know better than you. So it's a bit like a message in a bottle, a footnote.
Yes.
And the third thing is just the idea of a page as a performance, as complex. As an ex-medievalist, I was used to looking at manuscript pages where lots of things are going on. So where monks were writing things, and there might be badly behaved animals, or you'd know something was important to God was in red. But basically, there'd be no text that didn't have lots of visual layer. I think it's a bit of a pity that poems are supposed to sit like epitaphs and gravestones now, with nothing but black or white around them.
And T.S. Eliot had no problem with using footnotes and epigraphs, of course. So there is a good precursor.
There is, yes. Someone like Apollinaire making the page move like rain, which isn't exactly the same as footnotes, but it is making the eye use the space of the page.
That's an extraordinary poem, isn't it?
The rain.
Well, that little book, your chapbook, and all the other chapbooks that we produce here, are designed by Karen Florence, who is a letterpress artist and book artist, and she talks about print performance. And she says that although poets speak about their work as though it's the ear and the rhythm, in fact, what we're doing all the time is thinking about where we put the words on the page and how we space them and how we match the weight of the blank with the alternate density of the text. So I think print performance is the term that she uses.
Oh, that's very interesting, and I would love to read more or hear more of what she said. I was very grateful to her for using such a beautiful serif font for my poems. And I was interested in the editing panel at the Poetry on the Move earlier session, where one of the editors talked about using little tricks like kerning to make longer lines fit where they wouldn't otherwise fit, or a three-page poem turn into a two-page. But, I mean, there are two aspects to that, really. One is letting the object have a kind of integrity, but another is subjecting it to curious sort of compression. And I wonder why there shouldn't be more books that unfold the way that Anne Carson's Knox is the sort of book in a box that unfolds.
Yes. And actually John Berger and John Christie's I Send You This Cadmium Red has several unfold pages as well. so you can get the sense, the speciality of what's going on the page.
Yes, yeah, so someone like Maya Chowdhury, who's a north of England-based interactive artist, and she does paper objects and sort of interdimensional or multidimensional revolving website objects that correspond with poems of the same title. Mm. So you can never, I mean, it's interesting bibliographically because you've got one title but a multiplicity of works.
Completely. It's after Montague Summer's translation of the Malleus Maleficarum, which, as some of you will know, is the Hammer of Witches, the witch-hunting manual used in the early modern period, and translated less than 100 years ago in 1928 by Montague Summers, who reminds us that women, being the weaker vessel, are more prone to channel the devil and do things, you know, like create glamours upon men and detach their penises, which they then keep as pets. I have not tried this at home. Witches would detach penises, keep them in the 17th century equivalent of matchboxes, and feed them oats. Look out the window, horizon and white boats. It's breakfast time.
Is there a relationship, do you think, with the medieval practice and the contemporary, you know, the hypertext possibility moving into wall text, moving into more formally graffiti, and playfulness on the page? Do you think have we gone back to the medieval sense of the space?
It does feel very, very much as if we're going back to medieval senses of space and also of self, with the increase in the visibility of confession. You get a performed self, except it's a kind of universal eye on social media or the internet, for which the self is performed, whereas previously it would have been for your king or for your god.
Yes.
There's a sort of turning inside out of the self perpetually.
One of the things that came up in the panel on editorial work this festival, and also came up in a separate panel last year's festival, was the idea of republishing work. And do you re-edit it? Do you make it fresh? Should you republish anything at all? Should you do an ordnance, completely rechange all your works? You have some republished works in this little chapbook from books that have used it out of print. Can you talk a little bit about the logic of taking a poem somewhere else to a new space?
Well, one of the things is that if one thinks about poetry as a bit more like music, then it starts to make more sense. I think I am less unusual than I imagine, but perhaps unusual in admitting it, that a lot of my books arrive to me as books, which isn't to say that I have a list of titles and then fill in the poems, as somebody once asked me, but more that I have a sense of a shape and of whether the poems that arrive belong with that shape or belong in another book. So Measures of Expatriation, my 2016 book, I actually finished two or three other books during the same time, because I knew what those were, and I knew when poems belonged with those, or when I knew other poems belonged with that. And a kind of symphonic sense of the movements within a book. Mm. But then, when you think more musically, you can also recognize certain motifs, or think of the ability of reworking things into other forms, like suites or extracts, of a sort of a concert performance. And I realized there have been recurrent themes and also recurrent ways of playing with certain aspects of language. And I often used to think, well, I'd like to be able to put together all the tree ones, or all the ones where I talk about the sea, not in terms of describing the sea, but of a sea-like movement. And that's what doing this small pamphlet has enabled me to try. Mm. I very, very strongly don't want to change anything, though, partly because when I'm doing a book, I know what things belong together because I'm using particular techniques. Sometimes it was things like using three blank spaces to create musical pauses. Sometimes it's using clusters of stanzas dotted around the visual field of the page to suggest simultaneous thoughts that can't be selected for a particular order. But I can't always go back and recreate what I was doing. And so actually I'm terrified to disrupt something. I know I've made a delicately balanced object, but I don't I don't remember how I balanced it in all cases. I don't want to go unbalancing it.
After a hymn to Aphrodite, it's a springtime poem. One, that voice revises several languages. Look at the moon, my love. That sounds absurd. Ecco. Ecco la luna. Translators want to stay at home. Light sifting down like talcum powder. Don't we think of light and warmth together? Cold rock carries no weight, no. Interstellar space cannot impress us, to my knowledge. And if we put our skates on, though unplanned, each ecstasy's, each hesitation's trace does cut some ice in sharpened progress curved again by lines on whiteness. Then skies melt, et la lune descend. Translators tack an extra room onto the roof, a lungful of asbestos, their reward. Two lion-colored sentences wrote themselves in my mind at one of those highly ceremonial times when so much is involuntary, although everything should be willed, that you find yourself hoping not to have spoken. The thought of them makes me forget how much a line can take, forlorn within repeating borders. They did not scan at all, these sentences. I cannot place them, as if there were some empress whose perhaps greatest desire was to raise a pillar in sands outside her empire, where it is believed no city could be buried or built. Put the girls in florals. Eastertide. These trees are showing off their reproductive organs, mostly like a froth and creamy dazzle all over themselves, unstoppable. How confusing. Should someone take a swing at the flowering branches or lop them dead, perhaps on city orders? That is and isn't understandable. But they won't have it as a reason that these days, these trees are showing off their reproductive organs, displaying airy brilliance share of fruit. Strollers who designed a track of recollections, this side the river, that the concrete flats, sense fragrance, catch themselves rerouted, something dancing, a heart. I can imagine you blossoming with anger against yourself, face set against impatience. Your love is boundless, not your energy. It is given that you share this spring, the raindrop effect and warmth, another dazzle. I say it really is like that.
Can you talk about your sense of yourself in place and how you kind of put your roots, let your feet put roots down into the local soil or into the local narratives and imaginary?
Well, there are a few things that I'd like to say about that, and some of them are things that I've said before in other places. But one thing I think is that there are certain commonalities in people's ways of being which transfer from place to place. For example, are you a person who enjoys preparing food or not? Or are you a person who relates to animals or not? Or are you a person who is patient with those in pain or those who can't move or not? And if you fall into certain categories like that, or are you somebody who plays music or who listens to music, who tells the stories and listens to the stories, then as you travel, you still find yourself in certain groups or gravitating towards certain individuals and roles, or sometimes being inducted into things as if you already belonged when you didn't think that you belonged. For example, once when I went into the deep countryside in Trinidad, which although I grew up in Trinidad, I was a girl from the capital, I was an urban girl. In the deep countryside, there was a family wedding for somebody I knew. And because I like cooking, I started to be among the women who were making about 600 sweets by hand. So I was suddenly inducted into this group. So I think there is that there are these much larger groupings would create a belonging, which in some ways is activity-based or temperament-based and far deeper than ethnicity or religion or the other dividers.
Mm.
The other thing I think is that some people are naturally travellers and others are sort of quickly rooted. And although I seem to be travelling, I think I'm one of the more quickly rooted people. So very, very quickly I would start to feel, well, this is my tree, or I'm attached to this lake.
And it becomes yours.
It becomes mine, and I start to gravitate towards it. It becomes a reference point.
And can you drop that reference quite, that relationship easily if you move somewhere else? You don't hanker for the lake that you knew?
It isn't a question of hankering, it's a question of layering. And this goes back to one of the very first things you said about the plurality in my poems. Mm. And one of the reasons I think that some UK editors disliked my poems or saw them as needing more editing, which is a problem I still have, is that things layer themselves. So one particular tree, say a tree in Trinidad, will quickly attach itself in my mind to a somehow similar tree in Oxford, say in an arboretum, and both trees might turn up in one poem, or they might coalesce into a kind of relation of tree-ness to human.
When do you remember writing your first poem or thinking your first poem?
The thing is that my father was a poet, and my mother still recites poetry from memory. Mm. So I always used to make things up into rhymes. And I used to write down rhymes very early, but I first began taking myself very seriously when I was 6 years old. It was just when I was six that I had a proper-sized copybook of my own.
Oh.
Yes, I remember putting things into indents to look like poems in print. And those were my first real poems. I think they were typical childhood subjects, like what I had seen outside, deeply exciting things like the sky.
Yes. You still write about the sky.
I do.
And so I think most of us do. It's a big part of our lives. So it wasn't just kittens and puppies and flowers then.
Well, I wasn't really allowed to have pets. Trinidad's quite a cruel culture in that way. They're guard dogs. Very, very few people I know have pets. They're sort of guard dogs that will just eat you.
Mm.
They're not really socialised. Or there are people who are incredibly sensitive and almost ferociously bleeding heart. And then they'll have lots of rescue animals and quail and donkeys and whatnot. But there isn't anything in between. Salthill Blue for Mr. Loughlin. Thinking unlike a poet, quit making it new, or dragging netted memories for the breathless why. This milky blue is also taffeta, a sheen of pouring fabric beyond a purchaser's means. The sea creeps up on walking, on the unsinkable sun, shoes unburying seaweed, sandworms burrowing down. Salvaterra by Nicholas Loughlin, from The Strange Years of My Life. I saw it myself, the sun that dropped in a lake of blue milk, a blue god, bird-mantled, sweating honey, golden captain, Christmas astronaut, dropping like a pearl, and the highest air, hot glass, sticky horizon. I saw it myself. I have blue milk on my hands, doubting Matthew, doubting Jude.
You know, we know Shelley's notion that poets are the unacknowledged legislators of the world, something with which I have difficulty with that. But nonetheless, it's interesting. Do you see poets as being, in some ways, the conscience of the age?
The thing is that the word poet in poetry is so incredibly wide, and I used to be a lexicographer. I find that quite a hard question to answer straight off, because a poet could be somebody deploying a strict classical form to whip up nationalistic fervour.
Yes.
Or a poet could be somebody sort of splattering things onto a page in a drug-fueled haze in a New York studio. It could be either thing.
Mm.
Legislator, I think, is interesting because in the recent political events in America, for example, people have been turning to the lawyers to save them, whereas up to this point, lawyers were mostly the butts of jokes. But the idea that there should be precise language, which is predicated on the idea that there may be reasonable and civil behaviour over large groupings of people, has suddenly come into vogue and attention in a way it didn't before.
Mm.
Also, I think what's interesting is that Shelley was aware of slavery And that gets left out in overly romantic readings of Shelley. I mean, he was definitely a sort of post-colonially aware poet. Now, I don't want to be one of the sort of neo-colonial people who arrives and after what feels like 2 days awake in Australia and going to one session and start talking about relationship to country. But what I found it very interesting was an openness of acknowledgement, admittedly in this very specialised environment of a university poetry conference in a planned town, an openness of acknowledgement of historical interconnection and guilt and violence and new connection and an ability to try to have a dialogue and to respect, to be aware of infringing taboos, and a sort of relentless and refreshed relationship to being in a huge land. And that's something just completely absent from the UK at the moment. You don't really find any acknowledgement that a quarter of the world was pink.
Yes.
And that therefore there were people all over, of all colours, who reasonably now think of Britain as a home, that the idea of having two homes was inculcated in people for 400 years, and now those people are being told, go home.
And the last one was written in a small festival on the west coast of Ireland, off the west coast of Ireland, the westernmost island, Boffin, which is very, very small. You can see one side of it from the other. It's naturally a community under threat by climate change, and so the festival is known as Island Conversations and is completely themed upon the island, its local history, the effects of climate change, and also whatever international artists are there reinterpreting it. There's a rare bird called a corncrake, which sort of goes and they do this quite loudly at night. The name is Crex Crex. A stranger bringing water to a stranger. One unlocked house among all unlocked houses. A line of stone along a line of clover. Beyond a road with stone and clover edges. A looked-for line between wet sky and water. Seems non-existence, large and swift, headed out, disappeared in a tilting and a pouring. How have I been so stupid and not known this? Heaven most probably is underwater, sounding with ease, increasing pressure on us. Too light for many stars, too soon for most birds. Cracks, cracks. A hidden and unvarnished corncrake. Some way ahead, Rebecca in the pink. Thank you so much.
That was Vani Cabaldeo. Hirupsi chapbook Seas and Trees is available at recentworkpress.com. Measures of Expatriation is published by Carcanet. This has been Poetry on the Move. I'd like to thank our guest, Vani Cabaldeo. This podcast is made possible by IPSI, the International Poetry Studies Institute, and the Centre for Creative and Cultural Research, Faculty of Arts and Design at the University of Canberra. Thanks for listening.